Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
Welcome to Hagman. It is the Hagman Report for today. You know, it's Thursday, May 28th, 2020, and I want to just tell everyone out there, thank you so very much for tuning into this program, for spreading the word about this program, Hagman Report Live, of course. Thank you so very, very much. Got a lot of emails yesterday about free trade, how expensive it is, playing off the title, of course, of yesterday's episode. And even got some recommendations for some vendors to take care of our K-Cup boxes. Oh, yeah, man. And actually, Eric the Tech, too, on his own had done some things to take care of that. So we're good to go. It's not that we ran out. It's just that we don't want to run out. And, of course, you know, what we've been trying to do is live as we talk, and that is to make sure that we buy American, support American industry, being a truly American company. And if you don't know what I'm referring to, of course, HagmanStore.com, HagmanStore.com. We have a delicious gourmet coffee. I'm telling you right now, it is, as far as I'm concerned, it's the best. I mean, I handpick the beans. I go out there and I have my slave labor, and me and my slave labor, we handpick the beans. We put them in a donkey cart. We get them to the coast, and then we put them on a boat. We row to the roaster, drop them off at the roaster. All right. No, seriously, HagmanStore.com, three different kinds of coffee, and they are the freshest beans out there, the most aromatic. What a great cup of coffee, I'm telling you. HagmanStore.com. If you want to be hyper-caffeinated, get the detective's choice. And then for you patriots, there's the Patriot Blend. And, of course, as we approach the revolution, there's the Revolution Blend as well. Eric the Tech had a lot to do with, well, he had a lot to do with everything, but in terms of the packaging, the design, and the marketing and such. But you know what? I was the tester, the taster, the taste tester. That's right. And some of you were, too, out there. Thank you so very much. Have a great show lined up for you today. Marvelous show. Oh, before I go on, folks, if you haven't done so already, my good friend, Rob Pewitt, Wisconsin Christian News. Oh, my goodness. If you haven't done so already, you got to subscribe. Wisconsin Christian News. This will keep you up to date. A lot of great writers in there. Hey, despite the fact that yours truly writes as a contributing columnist for Wisconsin Christian News. That's right. Get it anyway. Subscribe anyway. Go to WisconsinChristianNews.com. The cost of a hard copy and digital subscription, I'm telling you, it's very inexpensive. They hardly make any money. So do me a favor too and give generously as well, because this is the way, I believe, this is the way we're going to be going. I'm telling you right now, this is the future of Christian communication. And you look at me like, what? Yeah, that's right. Back to the future, right? This is the future, I believe. Because you see what's happening on social networking. You see what's happening with YouTube, YouTube, with Facebook, with Twitter. Ah, they're the enemy strongholds of liberal communists. Speaking about communists, the left admit their 2020 strategy is to keep us locked down until, of course, they have their way with us. Make that of that. Just hey, I'm just telling you, that's just the way it is. And it's interesting too, because briefly talking about Twitter, talking about Facebook, I'm looking at headlines. The politicized Twitter censors fail to fact check the Adam Schiff, of course, his debunked Russian collusion claims. Oh, they stand. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey stands by decision to fact check the president of the United States. Hey, we got a fact. Can you imagine? Can you imagine Barack Hussein Obama, Barry Satoru, Bathhouse Barry being fact checked? Oh boy. And of course, now what do we got? We have got riots. We have got unrest, civil unrest. We do. In Los Angeles. And here's one thing I noticed in all seriousness, and I'm trying to be lighthearted because the news is heavy. And to some extent, I'm trying to be a little bit lighthearted. But what I've noticed here, and let me pull this up real quick. I screen capped Drudge this morning, earlier today, actually. Once this morning and then earlier today. Violent protests rock Minneapolis. Mayor begs for peace. National Guard called in. He'd be alive if he was white. Look, I get the fact that there is institutional and inherent racism in this country, and I despise it. Absolutely despise it. But you can see what the left is doing. They're capitalizing and politicizing things like this. And you've got Hollywood, of course, chiming in on this. And this is why I love my guest today. I'm really going to give the floor to. We're going to have some dialogue, but I'm going to give the floor to. Because every week when he's on the prophecy updates, John Haller, who is an attorney and the pastor of the Fellowship Bible Chapel, it's fbchapel.com, Fellowship Bible Chapel on Facebook, of course. Folks, the links will be in the program description box at HagmanReportLive.com. But I tune in every Sunday to their message, specifically to John Haller's prophecy updates. You know why? I can relate. And I think him and I are on the same page with things. And I had a great conversation, off-air conversation with John Haller yesterday, about a number of things. I'm not going to get into that because, he'll tell you about, the things that are taking place. But right now, things are pretty dicey and it's really difficult to keep up on a daily basis. And he's attempting to do so on a weekly basis. And boy, I'll tell you, his sermons are just fantastic. So if you have not done so, again, the links will be in the program description box at Hagman Report Live. If you haven't done so, every Sunday while you're going through withdrawals from this show, every Sunday, tune into the prophecy updates by John Haller, because he covers a lot of the same stuff we do, most of it, even better. Starting out, I'm going to ask him, in fact, we can start out by talking about really the continued attempted overthrow, the continued coup of our government. And remember how this all started out. It started out with the untethered, unfettered spying on American citizens, including but not limited to our president right now, President Donald John Trump, and of course, his members of his family. The FISA abuse, the accusations of Russiagate, then Ukraine, and on and on. Now we're tossed with this pandemic. So anyway, but where this started, really, or where this took hold, at least one avenue, was with Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. Sidney Powell, who I've had the opportunity to speak with and to exchange a dialogue with, is Michael Flynn's attorney. And let me tell you, she'll take no prisoners. Her book, License to Lie, what a great read. That's Sidney Powell. But again, with me is John Haller. I'm not going to take any more of his time. Again, I'm going to pretty much give him the floor. Mr. Haller, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Haller. Is my sound okay?
Your sound is fabulous. You look great. So we're good to go.
Okay. Where to begin? Let's start with the Michael Flynn thing. We talked a little bit about that yesterday in our phone call. And I mean, it was pretty clear that Flynn has some personal issues, I think, that you know, I'm concerned about. I did not like his relationship with Turkey. That's another issue that's kind of exploded in the news just this morning. We can talk about that in a little bit, if we remember it. But, it's pretty clear that Flynn had opposed some of the things that were being done in the Obama administration, and he had come under fire by the Obama administration, and they decided to unmask him in the FISA investigations. And, you know, it's very interesting. This unmasking has not really been done, but in the, at the end of the Obama administration, there were a number of things that were done that had really never been done before in American history.
Very true.
And we were all, and I think we were all very concerned when the FISA Act, and some of the surveillance acts were enacted after, the incidents in, September 2011. So the Obama administration engaged in this campaign to, bring down Flynn and as a result, bring down Trump. And essentially the unmasking occurred because Flynn had talked to, a Russian ambassador. I'm having a lot of trouble with allergies this spring, so I will mute my mic as much as possible when I get ready to cough.
No worries.
But I apologize if I miss it on occasion. So Flynn talked to the Russian ambassador, and that was apparently, at least what I've been able to determine, used as a pretext for unmasking him and getting information on him. And there were, I think Sidney Powell indicated recently that there were 39, at least there were documents released, indicated there were 39 or so unmaskings, 39 different people sought to have these conversations that would involve Flynn unmasked. This is really unprecedented stuff. And so they built this flimsy case on it. And now when they talk about it, they admit that they really don't even have a basis for an investigation. The FBI has admitted this. But nevertheless, during the course of the investigation, Flynn told something that was untrue. They charged him with a crime. And now 3 years later, we're still sitting here, arguing about whether Flynn should be let go. And the government has now agreed to let him go. But the judge in the case, an Obama appointee, has decided that, well, no, the government wants to not prosecute him. And of course, Flynn is on board with that and agrees to it. But we're going to, I'm going to continue the thing. I'm going to appoint this retired judge who wrote an op-ed in one of the mainstream newspapers, the Washington Post or the New York Times, telling why dismissing the case against Flynn was a miscarriage of justice. And Doug, I think we've talked about this in the past. This is what they do in these criminal investigations. A lot of times you end up where there's really no underlying crime that they can prove, but they conduct an investigation. And if you say something untrue during the course of the investigation, you can be prosecuted.
Knowingly untrue. I mean, if it was your intent to lie as opposed to, misstating. Yes. Go ahead.
Define knowingly untrue, though, because, listen, I will confess that in the course of representing clients and business and transactions, I represented a client that ended up in a financial scandal. And I myself, because I was going to be representing some of the people that were executives at the company and the civil litigation and the ultimately criminal cases that flowed out of that, the government, and these were a lot of the same guys that are involved in the Mueller probe. So I know a little bit about how they operate and what they did to me personally. And I've really talked about this. I was subpoenaed to an FBI interview. So I had to retain an attorney to be with me at that FBI interview. And the interview lasted, I think, 3 or 4 hours. You're in a room with an FBI guy. You're in a room with a U.S. attorney. And you're in the room with a couple of other people, usually Treasury or IRS people or others that have investigated the matter for a long time. And because my client had filed for bankruptcy and in the bankruptcy, they waived the privilege. every email that I had ever written about the client or to the client was given to the government during the course of that process. But the interesting thing is, in 3 or 4 hours in the interview, they maybe showed me one or two, now I take it back, 3 or 4 documents. And so the rest of it, the interview, was a memory test. Did you ever write this email? Well, if I didn't answer that correctly, or I'd not been prepared on how to answer that, that, you know, I could say, I really, as I'm sitting here, I don't remember it, but if you have something to show me, please show me to refresh my recollection. But I was prepared on how to answer that question. But a lot of people go into those things unprepared. They think that they will never be asked questions, that they might remember every email that they ever wrote. But if you're like me, you know, I get, between my personal and business account, at the law practice, you know, some days I get 400 emails at the law firm. So it's, and I was working on a big case for that client at the time, and I was getting, anywhere from 150 to 200 emails, 250 emails a day just on that case, because we had, you know, probably 15 attorneys that I was helping manage working on the case. So it's very easy that there would have been emails that have crossed my desk that I never really remember. But in the investigation, they never really show you those emails. And so this trips up a lot of people. There are a number of prosecutions that have occurred. I think this is part of what might have happened to Roger Stone as well. It's a memory test. And, you know, if you're not, they can make your life a living hell. I don't know how else to describe it, because you have to hire attorneys, and attorneys are expensive. And as an attorney, I'm grateful for that, by the way. But when you have to hire them, it's not such a great thing. But so, because they did not want me representing executives in the case that ultimately got charged with a crime, they engaged in this campaign, essentially, I think, to intimidate me to not represent these parties. They tried to disqualify me in the case. I got drugged not once, not twice, but 3 times. I was subpoenaed to testify in front of the grand jury. And the grand jury, listen, I'm an experienced trial lawyer, but I can tell you that it's an intimidating experience for anyone. I'm sitting there, and you have no attorney in the grand jury room. It's the prosecutors and 23 people on the grand jury that are there. You have no right to object or anything like that. So this happens to people, and this is what they did with Flynn. And I think it's an abuse of the system that's arisen. And listen, when it was done to me, it was during the Bush 43 administration. So it's a bipartisan effort to intimidate people into getting these guilty pleas. And so this is what they did with Flynn. They threatened to ruin him financially. They threatened to go after his family members. Now, look, I didn't lose sleep over it, but I know from having other clients that have been through the process, they do lose a lot of sleep over it, because their liberty and freedom is at risk. And it's very interesting in these big cases. When you have a civil lawsuit, you're entitled to discovery of documents. You're sort of entitled to that in terms of the federal government's case, or exculpatory documents, but the government very often takes the position that there's no exculpatory evidence. Or if they do disclose what documents are going to use before trial, they make it very difficult to find them. So in the one case that I'm thinking of, once all the documents from this company that had collapsed in this financial problem, crisis, scandal, whatever you want to call it, there were 38 million pages of documents. That's a lot of information to go through. And so they were in boxes in a warehouse, and the government would say, well, you know, these documents are in that box. Well, you know, it's 8,000 pages that you got to leaf through to find it. And it's literally a needle in a haystack type thing. So unless you have incredible means, but even during the course of trial, Doug, and this is probably off topic, but it may be not that interesting, I remember they had a FBI witness that was going to testify, And the morning that he, the day before he testified, I was given 8 of these, 5 or 6 inch thick notebooks and said, he's probably going to refer to documents in his testimony. So there I am with, probably 2,500 pages of documents to read overnight and prepare cross-examination form. That doesn't even happen in a civil jury trial. You'll have that information long in advance of trial, but in, when your liberty's at stake, it seems like you have less rights. In the government, lawyers want to win the case and pad their resumes and that sort of thing. And so they, are we still?
Yeah, something just happened there. I'm not sure. Eric, the tech, we okay? Yeah, we're okay.
Okay, sorry. I noticed that one of my lines into my, was a little bit loose and I wiggled it. So for some reason it changed the background, but that's fine. So in any rate, so you have so here I am. I have 2,500 pages of documents to review, and it turns out that the witness in his direct examination testimony at trial only referred to a small portion of one of the notebooks. And so that meant I had read 5 other notebooks full of documents all night long that he never referred to, but you got to prepare cross-examination. So as I did my cross-examination, I had an extensive outline prepared, and I remember I started, he testified for about 6 hours on direct. I did a couple hours of direct before they sent the jury home for the day. And the judge goes, are you going to finish in the morning before lunch? He says, I don't think you are because you haven't looked at your notes yet. You just done, 2, 3, 4 hours of cross-examination just off the top of your head. So these very complex cases, all this to say that this is what they were trying to subject Flynn to, and to try a case like this and defend it is incredibly, and find a lawyer to do it is incredibly expensive for people. Most people can't afford it. General Flynn couldn't afford it, and as a result, he pled guilty. And then it became evident after Sidney Powell got involved, and listen, she's a tremendous appellate lawyer down in Texas. She's very, very bright, very competent. Certainly what's happened in the Flynn case, I think, would be a good advertisement for her that, if you are really in trouble and you need someone that's going to dig to find the truth and to get you set free, she's certainly one of the people that you should consider. So to make a long story short, Flynn was subjected to this. He pled guilty. Sidney Powell found some things. And now they find out that the whole pretext, the whole basis for conducting the investigation was totally bogus. There was no reason for Flynn to even be subjected to an FBI interview. Right. Thus, whether he told the truth of that or not is totally irrelevant. But this guy's been essentially bankrupted. So what's happened now is the judge says, okay, I'm not going to dismiss the case until somebody – I'm going to ask a friend of the court to come in, this retired judge, federal judge, and he's gonna say why this is a travesty of justice for me to dismiss the case, even though the government wants the case to be dismissed.
I want to ask you, when have you seen a case where the prosecution, or in this case, the government ever say, in the interest of justice, we're just gonna not prosecute. We're not gonna continue with the prosecution. And then a judge say, wait a minute. We're gonna take another look at it. When has that ever happened in your experience? Well,
yeah, Saturday is the 40th anniversary of being admitted to the practice of law. And I've seen it this many times.
Yeah.
Zero. I've seen a few things. But listen, in the D.C. Circuit, there's a case where the court was very clear that allowing amicus briefs like this, or having people who are not parties to the case argue the case, was improper. But and so all of this came down, I think, on Monday, March 11th, when the judge did this. Sidney Powell immediately filed a motion to strike this ruling. And when her team did that, they did not cite a Supreme Court case that had just come out on May 7th or 8th that addressed the issue based on a Ninth Circuit case. And we know the Ninth Circuit has a lot of problems from time to time, like all the time.
Yeah.
You know, they're always putting in their opinions about the, immigration laws and that type of thing. And in fact, the case that, if I recall correctly, the case that came to the Supreme Court was a case that involved a Ninth Circuit decision on immigration laws. And when it had been appealed from the district court to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, well, we want to hear from other people in this. So they went out and they got these left-wing pro-immigration groups, you know how they believe, to come in and argue. And in fact, when they had the argument of the case in the Ninth Circuit, they gave twice as much time, and believe me, in oral argument before these courts, time is like gold. So they gave twice as much time to these left-wing interest groups as they did to the defendant in the case to argue the case in the Ninth Circuit. It went up to the Supreme Court, and in a 9-0 decision. Now, how many 9-0 decisions do we ever see out of the Supreme Court anymore? And the majority opinion was issued by Justice Ginsburg.
Oh, all right.
And Justice Ginsburg said, no, you cannot do this. So that comes out on Thursday or Friday. On Monday or Tuesday, Judge Sullivan is doing exactly what the Supreme Court said he could not do. So Sidney Powell, in addition to filing that motion, she filed for a writ of mandamus. And in a very unusual decision, and this is something that I've had seen happen zero times before, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, where this case is pending, it's in the D.C. District Court. It's appealed to the D.C. Court of Appeals in the federal system. They said, Judge Sullivan, you have to tell us why you're not going to dismiss this case within 10 days, which was before the response that he had set up for this retired judge. So this is very unusual. This is a very much a totally, completely in-your-face thing that the district court is doing, or that the D.C. Circuit was doing to Judge Sullivan. So his response is due, I think, Monday. So we'll see how that goes. But look, this has just been clearly an attempt to bring down the Trump administration government. And there is, I cannot remember where I saw the report. It was on one of the conservative websites. Someone has speculated, and I think I would agree almost 100% with the speculation, that the massive unmasking that took place during the Obama administration of Flynn and some of the other people in the incoming Trump administration, who are going to be talking to these foreign leaders because they're going to be dealing with them on January 20th. And you want them to hit the ground running and be able to take over the reins of government. It's not improper. This has been done in every administration transition in American history. And nobody's been prosecuted over it. But the reason some are speculating now, and I think this is correct, is that the unmasking took place on such a massive scale that they did it so that they could eventually set it up so that they could actually go to court to get the court to issue a decision that the Trump administration should not be, that the election was somehow tainted and therefore the election should be thrown out. And I think this is exactly right. This is, I personally have no doubt that, you know, I had no love for the, Obama administration. In the last weeks of the Obama administration, and behind me, the screenshot that I have is a screenshot looking back up into the old city of Jerusalem from a place called the Promenade. I actually did a prophecy update there 3 years ago on May 21st when we were there. Bill Koenig and Brian Schrager and myself went down there and filmed it. And that this was the day before Trump came to Jerusalem, made his first trip to Jerusalem. He was in Saudi Arabia that day on his way to coming to Israel. But at the end of the Obama administration, for the first time, the United States had not vetoed a resolution that dealt with Israel and Jerusalem. They allowed the resolution. They didn't vote in favor of it. They abstained, but they didn't exercise their veto at the Security Council. And it was a massive change in U.S. government policy. And the audacity or the audacious thing that the Obama administration did during that process was the Trump administration, of course, is very much pro-Israel. We know this from what has transpired over the last 3.5 years. But they lobbied people at the UN, don't do this. And I think if they'd had more time, the Obama administration would have prosecuted them for exercising their rights to lobby someone on a policy that they weren't going to enforce or fulfill coming in. So it was clearly, there was just one thing after another that the Obama administration did. But I think probably that resolution on Jerusalem, that it was voted on by the Security Council on Christmas Day 2016, after the election, and only 4 weeks before the transition to the Trump administration was going to take place. They tried to completely change U.S. policy. I also think that what happened, Doug, and I think there's pretty good evidence of this, is that the there have been times, I will confess, that there have been things done in the Trump administration. It's been very difficult for things to get done. Now, you can say, well, the president's incompetent or they don't know what they're doing. But part of the problem is that government political appointees were transferred from political appointment jobs in various agencies. And this happened with, my understanding is, hundreds of people that were political appointees in the Obama administration. They were transferred to civil service protected jobs where it's almost impossible to fire somebody in policymaking positions and implementation of policy things throughout many agencies of government, which means that, you know, not only is Trump fighting Congress, but Trump is also fighting the bureaucracy, the deep state, if you will. So I think it's pretty clear that this did take place.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Transition. And thank you. I didn't mean to interrupt, but thank you for mentioning that, because I think it's important for people to really know that, look, President Trump is just one guy, and he's under, I'm not sure I could withstand, maybe you or I could withstand that kind of hammering. And when you have implants, people from the previous regime, salted into your
embedded in the agencies.
Yep. Yeah, I mean it's yeah. You're. I mean, you're constantly in battle. So thank you for pointing that out. Because I believe that President Trump, although some of the decisions, I think, you know, makes me shake my head sometimes. All in all, I think that he's doing his best to fight the swamp. But go ahead, sir.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know that I want to do it. The one thing that I always kind of marvel at with President Trump, this is kind of how does he wear those suits all the time and not sweat through them? I just don't know. You know, I'm a sweater, but I often marvel that he's able to go to these places and walk up and down steps and, you know, talk for however long he talks for, and he's not just drenched at the end. It's
Yeah,
as someone who's not able to do that, it's if you ever watch my updates, you know that when I get out, sometimes unfortunately to an hour and a half standing up there yapping, I'm sweating quite a bit. So I have fans on and all this stuff, and try to get the air conditioning turned down at church before I do that. But yeah, so look, he's had a difficult time. I think there are things that he's done that I can't explain. I don't approve of that. But, you know, I always keep going back to the fact is what would it be like if Hillary Clinton had been elected? Mm-hmm. That's sort of a thought that it keeps you awake at night even now, even though it hasn't happened.
You know, let me ask you this.
It's really been unlike anything that I've seen in my life.
I totally agree. But I gotta toss this question out to you, because I said this back in February. I said this last year. John, I can't predict the future, obviously, but I just have this weird, sick feeling in my stomach. We have not seen the last of Hillary Clinton yet. You've got Joe Biden rather weak and compromised, at least PR-wise, candidate for the Democrats. I don't know. I just – have we – any thoughts on Hillary kind of just getting back in, or would you poo-poo that notion at this point?
Look, based on? It went through a whole long, involved primary process in the Democratic Party. It was, of course, interrupted in a lot of their debates. You can praise the Lord for the coronavirus shutting that stuff down. Like, we can be grateful that the coronavirus seemed to shut down this ridiculous drag queen story hour stuff that was going on in schools and libraries for children. But I don't know. Is Biden the best they can do? They can come up with? I mean, how bad is the process when Biden is the nominee for one of the major parties?
That's a good point.
He defeated Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Pocahontas Warren, and some others, Kamala Harris. These people are, I just don't understand. You know, when I look at the political process, I got to think sometimes, like, are we under the judgment of God with the way this whole political process is going? It's really out of control. And then, so when the coronavirus stuff started coming up, the whole process with the relief and aid has been, in my view, just corrupt. The way they've tried to put all this stuff in for their pet projects and that type of thing. And so, you know, Republicans and conservatives have largely been, at least give lip service to being concerned about the national debt. And the national debt's gone up by $4 or $5 trillion in the last 2 or 3 months, and could go up another 12 or 15 trillion beyond that before this thing is all said and done. And we're just spending money like this. And, you know, money can be very corrupting. And where's it coming from? That's the question I always ask, is where's all this money that we're spending coming from? I was asking this question last year when we're running over $1 trillion a year deficit. And now we're running like a $4 trillion a year deficit. 1 year later, where's all this stuff coming from?
Yeah, exactly.
And what's the ultimate impact?
That's it. I am fearful as to what this is going to bring economically. I think we're going to see economic devastation like we've never seen before. And I keep hearing this, and I think we're in uncharted waters here, obviously. And I didn't mean to, interrupt
exactly.
You.
Exactly. We are in uncharted waters. I think I told you in our conversation yesterday. I'm kind of a conservative person. I am very conservative. And in some respects, I'm risk adverse. So I saw a crash coming based on the people that, you know, Armstrong and some other people that I follow and listen to, that at some point the world was in a massive debt fueled bubble, that there was going to have something happen that caused a crash. Well, look what happened. We've had a crash of epic proportions. I mean, every chart that you look like, I think the jobless reports came out this morning, and they now total over 40 million unemployment claims filed in the last seven weeks, maybe 8 weeks. In any event, that's an enormous number of people that are suddenly unemployed in this country. This is happening all over the world as well. I don't know where we're headed.
If I can ask you about that, when you consider the not the actual virus, the COVID virus, the what I call the communist Chinese virus, when you consider the release or the timing of the release of that, more appropriately, the response to the virus itself. On a global scale, yes, but specifically on the scale here in the United States. Do you find yourself asking questions? Could this all be just a massive coincidence when we've had record numbers, job growth, economic growth under President Trump? I know they're paper numbers or numbers on paper. I know that numbers can be munged and figured and, you know, moved around. I get all that. But in terms of our economy, it was going great guns. And the left had said, look, where President Trump is vulnerable is on the economy. And talk show is coming out and saying, crash the economy, let it burn if necessary, just to get Trump out of office. That said, my question is, could the response, not necessarily the actual virus, but could the response have been calculated to take out President Trump from this election in 2020?
Well, this is something I've read a lot about, so my opinion might be a little bit contrary to others. I sort of have what I would call a hybrid view of what happened. I think that I think the virus was real. I think that and I did a show with somebody else back in late January when China had just shut down, and what had happened in that 2-week period since when they started to shut down, I think in the middle part of January, it seems like it was a year ago, and it was only like four and a half months ago that this really all started. When I saw China shut down, I remember the host of that show and I talked about the fact that people needed to prepare, because my view was that there was a financial virus, a financial contagion unleashed when China shut down that was going to ripple through the economy. That was exacerbated by a price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia, an oil war to protect their market share, where they just started flooding the world with oil. But oil demand and gas demand in China dropped 25 to 50% in 2 weeks. That's a very, very large market. So all of a sudden we have the world flooded with oil, and the price has stabilized somewhat now, but it's still too low for the oil shale producers to really come back. A lot of them are filing bankruptcy or just have completely shut down. So my view was that there was going to be a collapse then. I was quite concerned. I do represent people with financial banking interests, including banks. And I had noticed for a few years that the banks were, and I'm not specifically referring to the clients that I might have had, but that lenders in general were very concerned about where this was all going, that there was too much debt out there. So when all this started to shut down, we had over 10 trillion in corporate debt. We had almost 2 trillion in student loan debt here in the United States. We had massive government debt and overspending. We have unfunded pension liabilities in the United States alone that probably total over $200 trillion. Promises that have been made that are not funded yet. And so at some point, the system has to unwind and crash. So being risk adverse, I pulled my money out of the market, essentially put it in cash. So now, look, I missed a big run up. I felt like an idiot, but you know, my accounts didn't go down during the crash. I had friends that lost well into the hundreds of thousands of dollars out of their retirement accounts because they were in the market. So I think the financial collapse was going to happen, and there's some. Whether you like the New York Times or not, the New York Times has a website, portion of their website, nytimes.com/upshot. And at the upshot portion, they have a lot of graphs. And one of the graphs they had a couple weeks ago, and I used it in a couple of my updates, was it showed the financial decline. And what you see of the financial decline is you see the financial decline happening starting back in February and March and sort of flattening out. Then the lockdowns in the United States started. So the financial decline, my view is that the China shutdown, the largest industrial power in the world now, that started the bursting the bubble. Now, the lockdowns have certainly exacerbated that and made it much worse. But a lot of what we see, in my view, is going to happen. So what I also see is, now, is this planned? Is this what people have planned to cause this economic collapse? I will profess to being somewhat agnostic on the subject, but I do know this. Whether the virus was intentional or unintentional and all that sort of thing, it is abundantly clear that when everything started, that we started having problems, there were plenty of people with agendas that sort of filled that space. So you see things that happen. I don't know if you've talked about it, but I followed the World Economic Forum for a number of years because this is where the elites of the world gather to kind of talk about what they have planned and what they like to have seen see happen. And so this year they were sort of talking about, I think one of the talks, we can talk about it later if you want, was by a Israeli professor, Hariri, from Tel Aviv University, who talked about how to survive the 21st century. And I have to tell you, listening to his talks, which I think are some of the most important talks that have been given at the World Economic Forum in terms of artificial intelligence and the future and that sort of thing, they're very dystopian. They're very much like, if you wonder how all of these things happen in Bible prophecy, they talk about these things at the World Economic Forum. So the World Economic Forum, it came out when all this COVID stuff was going. They had a website in place. It appears to have been put in place back in August of 2019. And it essentially has all of these subjects, including now a incredibly populated section for COVID-19. So if you go to weforum.org/strategic intelligence, you might have to sign up for a free account, but you can click on these things and they're kind of a circle with spokes. It looks sort of like the coronavirus, but they have global governance, LGBTQ issues, a section on COVID-19. And then when you go to COVID-19, there's this like spoke and wheel thing and you click on it. And there's just article after article after article. And they're, if you follow this, just the COVID-19 one, they're populating this thing with new information every day. And I'm talking like extensive analysis. So they talk about how can we use COVID-19 to promote global governance, things that, you know, we Christians are quite concerned about from a Bible prophecy standpoint. So how this thing came about, it seems like it appeared overnight. It didn't, but it's run by artificial intelligence. All the links work. There are no broken links. And you know how hard it is to put something up on a website and a year later, the links are all broken, right?
Yeah.
This thing, everything works. I've been through hundreds and hundreds of articles and all of this stuff is there. And it really lays out what the global elites want to do. So as this COVID thing came on, again, I'm not making an opinion as to whether it was intentional or not. Certainly, at a minimum, there were all sorts of people ready to jump in and take advantage of the crisis. You know the old rubric, the Saul Alinsky rules for radicals, Emmanuel, Rahm Emanuel, never let a crisis go to waste. Yep. So, and we see this, Doug, you see this daily now. Right? I mean, yesterday, when did this thing start in Minneapolis? With the protest over the guy who was, and I watched the video. It's horrific what happened to those guys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Within the last 36 hours, anyway, the riots and protests and such, the protests and then turned into riots within the last 36 hours.
Okay. I mean, I've heard there were protests in Memphis, Los Angeles. They essentially totally devastated, ransacked a Target store in Minneapolis during the looting that's followed this, and so now the question is, well, is somebody funding these protests? And because Antifa and Black Lives Matter and all these people are jumping in to push their agenda. Every time something happens now, There's like all these people that want to rush in to fill that space.
Exactly. Yeah, you're exactly correct. So, yeah.
So we see this with the coronavirus lockdowns, you know, and I agree with the concerns that, you know, marijuana stores can stay open, abortion clinics can stay open, but churches can't. I think there might be somewhat of a reason when you consider concepts of viral load and that type of thing about concerns about churches and large gatherings, also sports and that type of thing, which I don't know are coming back anytime soon.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting. I mean, and people don't know really what to do. I mean, I got an email from a court reporter that I've used many times over the years, taking depositions. And, you know, in case people don't know, you go in a deposition, you have a court reporter sitting there next to the witness with one of those steno machines. You have an attorney. You have an attorney representing the witness. You have an attorney representing. And you might go into a room where there – now, I've been in rooms where there are 50 people at a deposition because of the multiple parties in the case. And it can turn into a free-for-all at some point. But they're all in a room. Like, I remember, this must have been, it was 12 years ago. It was 2008. I remember I was in New York City, you know, in one of the office buildings there near Radio City Music Hall at a big law firm. And we probably had 40 or 50 attorneys in the room for this deposition. In addition, we had probably 150 watching online. They were streaming the deposition. So I get a email from a court reporter yesterday. And she's very intelligent. She's very competent. You know, how they can keep up with you and, you know, what you're saying and get it accurate like they do is amazing to me. But she said, I don't know that we're going to have depositions like we had for some time. And she has an article from somebody at University of Massachusetts or MIT or someplace talking about sitting in a room with people for a long time. If one of them is sick, everybody's exposed extensively to the coronavirus. But that doesn't happen if you're just passing by people occasionally in a sand, you know, like a Walmart or a Kroger or something like that, grocery store. You're not getting loaded with their, if they're off gassing the coronavirus, breathing it out, whatever, passing them by on a beach or walk or something like that. It's much different than sitting with them in a room for 4, 6, 8, 10 hours. Mm-hmm. And so what are we going to do? I mean, what's going to happen for the justice system? I was just looking at a case today, and the court here, we have some issues coming up in a bankruptcy that I'm working on representing a bank's interest. If I file an objection to what they want to do, The court is essentially shut. They'll do things telephonically, but it's hard to present evidence and that type of thing and examine people telephonically. It just really does not work. But they're not doing anything until July 2nd, at least.
Exactly.
So even if I, but they haven't done anything since, you know, March 1st. So from March 1st to July 1st, that's 4 months. Everything's been put on hold. So now when they start to do things on July 2nd, if they start then, everything is backed up and the whole system is.
It's overloaded.
It's shut down and it's overloading as it's shut down because people are still trying to, you know, do things in their life.
Exactly. And, you know, look, I'm involved in litigation. And this has, just as we're entering into the discovery period, I mean, this has just set things back incredibly. And I've been an investigator for almost as long as you've been a trial lawyer, and I've never seen in court testimony anything even resembling what I see now. So you make a good point. What's going to happen in the near term? And for the next, I don't know, in the short term, I should say, what's going to happen? And how is this going to be? I don't know.
How does the system work out? I mean, I'll give you an example. I have, you know, I do a lot of commercial foreclosures, mostly high end, I would say multi-million dollar prop value properties, office buildings, restaurants, auto parts stores, strip centers, that sort of thing. And, you know, now since I had a foreclosure that I finished up in March, I was able to finish it up January the 6th. And there was one aspect, we actually closed on that aspect yesterday. So my client will be paid by tomorrow and I'll be out of that. But other foreclosures, you can file all the foreclosures you want, but the courts have all put 60, 90, 180 day holds on all of this. Well, this has a huge impact on the commercial real estate market, because during a while, cases in foreclosure, unless you evict the person or get a receiver, they still have control of the property until you get your foreclosure. And under the best of circumstances, I do mine, I think, more quickly than just about anybody. I've been able to get, you know, to the sale point and finish within 5 months, which is very unusual. Usually it takes anywhere from 9 months to a year and a half or 2 years. And the person's using the property that whole time. They may be not paying you any rent or not making a mortgage, I would say not rent, but a mortgage payment. And so the whole system grinds to a halt. But then let's say you have, you know, this developer is supposed to be making mortgage payments to the bank. The restaurants there are shut down. They're not making rent payments. So the mortgage, the guy making the mortgage payments can't make the thing, and the whole system just starts to unwind. Let me give you an example. I was talking to one of my people that I use when I did the auto parts store in Eastern Ohio recently. I hired him to come in and liquidate the auto parts inventory. So he was talking, he says, look, the people he talks to in the commercial real estate market say that commercial real estate and people that I talk to, they think it will decline in value 40% very, very quickly at a minimum. Well, that has a huge impact on banks' bottom line and the banks, what their working capital and that sort of thing. And the Fed stepped in to kind of try to suspend those ratios that the banks usually have to, they usually have like a percentage of working capital. Like if they have $1 million in loans, they have to have 7 or 8% of that in liquid cash, liquid assets in the bank. Well, now they don't even have to have that because the Fed has kind of pushed to suspend that. But what happens when everything, I mean, will the banks survive? Nobody's making payments. I see these developments around town. I drive around. I get out every day just because I would go stir crazy sitting in the house. And I went to the office Monday. I'm in a second largest office building in the city of Columbus, city in the suburbs of about 2 million people. And it's the headquarters of Huntington Bank. And there's a place where the Huntington Bank executives park. I've been there 4 times over the last month, and it's totally empty. There's not a single car in there. And then this huge, you know, 6 or 7 level parking garage attached to the Huntington Center, which is 40 stories. There, on each level, there might be 5 to 12 cars. Yeah. The people at Rudd Security at the building say 80 to 100 people maybe come in. Now, things are supposed to open up on Monday pretty much. At least our office is planning that. But I'm just, it's like this dystopian world. And what's happening, though, is people that have commercial leases and this type of thing, they're going to their landlords and they're saying, I have 10,000 square feet of office space. I'm never paying you another dime of rent on this. You could sue me. I'll collapse the company. And you could pursue me in foreclosure or bankruptcy or eviction. And you're on hold for 90 days, or at least another 60 days. But instead of leasing 10,000 square feet, I'll lease 1,500 square feet at a reduced rate because all my people, I find out, can work at home. Well, what happens to the value of commercial real estate? So it drops in value. This is why people are saying, experts in the field, 40% in commercial office buildings. My friend who does the liquidation, somebody says, hey, I have I own the property where, a half dozen restaurants lease the restaurant building from me. And they're not paying. They're never going to operate again. And they just said, listen, come and take whatever you want. We're never opening the door again. Would you liquidate the restaurant equipment for me? And he said, my friend told me, he said, John, I'm telling you that once all this thing starts to open up and the liquidations start, I wouldn't touch a restaurant with a 10-foot pole. You'll be able to go buy a $5,000 commercial gas range, one of those enormous gas ranges, for $80.
Mm.
It'll cost you $20,000 to redo your kitchen to fit it in, but you'll be able to pick up the kitchen equipment. He said, it's not even worth it for me to go in there because I could liquidate six restaurants and they probably would not achieve enough value to pay my $2,000 basic fee for doing this. So I'm just telling you, Doug, I have never seen anything like this. I do not know how it resolves. I know we can all be optimistic. So my view, though, is a bit different than others. I do not think that it was the greatest economy.
Okay.
I think that it appeared on the surface to be the greatest economy. But my concern when I heard this being touted by people in campaign strategies and whatever was, if you're all in on I'm responsible for the greatest, you're going to take the fall if it's not. And right now we're in a stage of economic devastation that I've never seen. But on the other hand, this is what, so I feel like I'm living in this, like one of those Italian movies where things don't quite make sense,
Fellini
movie. But I think Fellini was one of these guys, and like it was disjointed and nothing made sense. And now it's like I drive around. So, I mean, we talked yesterday. I'm spending more time with the greatest woman a guy could ever be married to. Our 45th anniversary is Sunday. She's happy. We're eating better. We're eating more cheaply. And other than not seeing people at church and traveling, our life is actually pretty good. But I also see these people where it's just 40 million unemployment claims, probably way more than that are actually unemployed. A lot of these jobs are never coming back. And what are we going to do as a society to deal with this? And this, I mean, this plays into Bible prophecy. This sort of reeks of a man with a plan. But there are these weird things like, I told you we're signing the listing agreement on our house to sell it today, and we made an offer on another place today. And I'm reading reports today that it's a seller's market in a lot of places. Real estate values are going up, and you're thinking like, wait a minute, the economy is crashing, but real estate values in suburbs, in nice suburbs around big cities, are increasing in value. Even here in Ohio, we've seen places where certain neighborhoods have increased in value 15 to 20% since the middle of March or the beginning of April. And the world's what you're like, I'm smacking my head. It's like, how is this possible? But now, so today I'm reading a report from King World. I don't know if it's King World Syndicate or King World Economics or something. And it had just a little paragraph and it said, suburbs are growing in value. House sales are up. Mortgage rates are low. People want to buy something. And people that live in high-density apartments or condos near center cities all over America want to move to the suburbs. So if you got a house in a suburb, it's easy. Your value is going to go up. Another person said, well, I don't think the economy is that bad, a comment on YouTube, because you use cars. Used cars are increasing in value. So people are buying used cars. There's a shortage of used cars. And he says, so I don't think the economy's that bad. Now, it is that bad. It really is that bad. But look what's happened. New York City ridership on the subway down 95%. Washington Metro down 95%. A lot of those people are still employed, 70% or more. but they don't take the public transit. They need a car to get to work. So they're looking for a used car for transportation that they didn't need before. Used car price is supply and demand. But so there's these weird things where the economy is just roaring. You know, foods, you know, grocery stores are doing great. I think home improvement stores are doing great. But other things are just totally devastated. So it's such a disjointed world that we live in. It's, and then into that disjointedness, you have the political left, the global elites, the deep state, the globalists, all of these people who have an agenda to further what they want, and they're rushing in to take advantage of it. And I do think that plays into the Bible prophecy, and it's the old never let a crisis go to waste thing. It's on steroids right now.
Indeed. You know, and a lot of people, by the way, echo your sentiments, this dystopian situation in which we find ourselves. Folks, you're listening to the Hagmann Report. We're up against a network break for the top of the hour. Give me 2 minutes, and we'll be right back. My guest is John Haller, attorney, elder, teacher, known for his weekly prophecy updates. Going to be right back. Stay right where you're at.
Reporting on what the mainstream media won't, you're listening to the Hagmann and Hagmann Report on the Global Star Radio Network.
And welcome back. This is the Hagmann Report, where truth can't be silenced, no matter how hard they try. A very special guest today, John Haller. As I mentioned, he's a pastor, he's an elder, he's a teacher, and I want to wish him, first of all, a happy wedding anniversary, 45, this weekend. And also this weekend, he's marking his 40th year as a trial lawyer. He lives in Columbus, Ohio. And he's, I consider him a good friend and a good friend of the program. He's got an immensely popular, prophecy update that I watch. I use it for show prep. I really do. As a matter of fact, a couple of times I've taken a couple of excerpts, which you've seen, and of course with proper credit, and shown you what, John Haller was talking about. So happy to have him with us talking about just a wide range of things and how really strange and chaotic and dystopian everything is right now. Getting into the granular level, I believe at certain things. And how often have you heard anyone talking about the mechanics, like the commercial real estate aspect and the numbers, economic numbers and such. So very interesting indeed. I don't want to take any more of his time. Again, so very happy to have him, John Haller. John, thanks for hanging with me during the break.
Sure. I just to sort of give my wife acknowledgement, I was 19 years old when this beautiful blonde gal walked in and sat down across the aisle from me in English literature in my sophomore year in college. And I took her out, a couple months after that. And then about 6 weeks after that, we went out a couple more times and I proposed. And she used to introduce me. So we've been married 45 years, but I've only been a lawyer for 40. So that means the first 5 years of our marriage, I was a student. And she used to introduce me as, this is my husband, John, who's a student. But I'm looking forward to him graduating and supporting me in a manner to which I have not yet become accustomed. So she's been a real blessing and everything. And so it's been great. You know, so to me, the shutdown and lockdowns and stuff have not had that huge of an impact on my life other than the traveling thing. But I also know that there are people that are really, really suffering in this. So are you hearing noise in the background? I just wanted to know if, because we're listing our house. We have people here doing things and I can hear them banging around in the back. So I apologize for the background noise.
John, compared to some of the things I hear in the background of some of our guests, you're gold. So no worries.
Okay.
No worries at all.
Then maybe I just feel guilty about not being upstairs doing all that work, but I'm fine with that too.
All right. You know, we started out by talking about Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. By the way, I just saw it in the news. I want to just bring this to your attention. I don't know whether you happen to see this or not, but I find it very interesting. Where the heck is it? Right here. The former acting director of National Intelligence, Rick Grenell, has declassified the transcripts of the wiretap phone conversations between former NSA advisor Michael Flynn and Russian ambassador Sergei Kislyak. And I think it's interesting because it seems like the stage is being set for really exposing the nothingness behind that, behind all that brouhaha that took place. And, one of the things too that I see on the left message boards is, for crying out loud, Lieutenant General Flynn pled guilty to lying. And the reason I bring this back up again is because, again, one of those things is, well, how in the world can he have pled guilty to lying? And then the Department of Justice, they must be allowing him to get off. And it's not like that at all, because you're fighting a Leviathan when you're in that system. Mm-hmm. So I just want to kind of bring that up again. But it looks like. Go ahead.
I've not seen those reports of the transcripts yet, but my guess is that we're going to find that what was discussed with the Russian ambassador and others that led to this supposed unmasking and this massive, you know, Russian controlled conspiracy and all this other stuff, we're going to find them to be rather innocuous and not out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
And I think it just goes to show that this whole thing from the beginning was a put up job. So I will acknowledge that, you know, this is done to collapse the Trump administration, to interfere in the government. I'm not sure it rises to the level of treason. I see that bandied about quite a bit. I know there's all this hopeful, there's this hope that a lot of these people will be, you know, tried, convicted, and sent to jail or worse. I've never been that optimistic. I think a lot of that is hype. And I've often said that if 10 to 15 people end up being indicted and a few convicted, I will be happy with that. The elites in power on both sides have a way of protecting each other. So I'm not optimistic that much will come of this. We may have seen the best that there is, but it's also possible some indictments will come. I do appreciate Attorney General Barr stepping in to put a stop to this nonsense. As I said, having seen the system up close, I think the system has long been out of control, and there are people on Mueller's team that I know about and what they've done. I mean, Doug, think back. The Mueller team were a lot of the guys were involved in the prosecution of Enron. And what did they do? They collapsed Arthur Anderson.
Oh, yeah. 85,000 really, jobs. 85,000
very well-paying jobs of people who were – and I knew people who were consultants for Arthur Anderson and stuff. And now a lot of them moved on to other companies and that type of thing. But a decent company was destroyed – for really nothing.
Right.
I mean, year after years of litigation, the Supreme Court essentially said, You should have never done that. Well, you know, where do those people go to get their life back? And so now we have it in sort of, not only has it happened on the prosecution side in a off sometimes corrupt FBI and Department of Justice investigations, now we have these little, I don't know how to describe it. So, and I have mixed emotions about that, because I do think that this virus thing was in some places it was very bad, and it caused like this huge spike in daily deaths in many, many places, but it didn't turn out to be as bad as everybody was afraid. But nevertheless, we have these little neo-fascist dictators running around as under the guise of I'm an elected governor of a state, shutting everything down, issuing all these rules, some of which make absolutely no sense. And so as the threat of the coronavirus goes away, as the threat of the coronavirus goes away or lessens, I think, over time, at least appears to be, the rules aren't, they're not walking back any of the rules. So this is a concern. I mean, we've entered, as you've said a number of times in this interview, uncharted territory. I don't know where it's going. I'm very concerned about it. And it sets the place, it sets the world up for what in Bible prophecy is a coming world leader, a man with a plan. And I think that that's probably more of a possibility. Everybody's running around saying, can't we just solve this thing? Who can solve this thing? Who's got the answer?
That's
and
a
so
good point.
We know in Bible prophecy, and look, even we, I think, as Christians who know about this coming, we're running around too saying, well, why can't somebody just take care of us? So some friends of mine, I think, have made some good points that Satan's running a lot of this stuff in the background, and he's running both sides of this. And so there's, as you know, last week I did sort of a takedown of a video that supposedly was a Department of Defense briefing at the Pentagon from 2005 involving a vaccine, a fundamentalist vaccine, they called Funvax, for the God gene. Well, that's never been proven in science. There's huge theological implications for it. And what happens is Christians, and they're well-meaning and well-intentioned and everything, they're sharing this video like crazy. So I sort of, if you want to watch my update, I spent a good half hour sort of unpacking that video and why I think it was staged and not something to be relied upon and doesn't really state valid science. So I think that we need to be careful as Christians. We need to be people that are committed to truth. I mean, you know, look, we can oppose this vaccine agenda that is running rampant right now. I personally don't think that they're going to come up with a vaccine for this. Even the people that are proponents of it, even the Faucis and the Gates, they say, well, we don't know if this is work. It's untested technology. And so in the context of that, you have to their own listen, as a lawyer, the one thing that we always try to do in a trial or whatever is use somebody's words against them. So there's plenty of statements by Gates and Fauci and those people to use against them. We don't have to make stuff up, is what I'm trying to say. We
Correct.
Need to be people of truth.
Right.
And so that's where I'm concerned. So I'm a little less, I think if you've watched me, I don't really run with all the latest theories, conspiracy theories, whatever you want to call them, because I'm kind of like, I really want to vet this. The truth is really important to me. I don't like it when people come into court on the opposite side of a case. If you want to get my dander up, come in and misrepresent what a document says or quote somebody out of context. That really gets me fired up because that's dishonest and it's untruthful. Unfortunately, in the legal system, I don't know if we've ever talked about this. I've mentioned this before other places. When I was a young trial lawyer back starting in 1980, I would go to seminars about how to be an effective trial lawyer. I did seminars myself not after not too many years about how to effectively present evidence, how to, I mean, I was doing slideshows with toxicology experts and touchy feely things that so the jury could really understand what was going on, models and that type of thing early on. And when this stuff was really not all that popular, but I was always concerned about being factual and truthful. And the seminars said, this is how you effectively present facts. But back in the 90s, I can't give you the exact date, but the seminars for trial lawyers changed. And they went from, this is how you effectively present evidence, to this is how you appeal to people's emotions. And it was pretty clear to me then that we had entered into the postmodern world where everybody had their own truth. And it's very interesting that if you study passages in 2 Timothy chapter 4, Paul writing to Timothy, and as I've said before, I did a series once at church, a class I was teaching called Famous Last Words. I went through like the last sermon of Moses, the last sermon of Joshua, the last words of Paul, the last words of Jesus. Because it's like when you're facing death and at the end of your life, you sort of remember what's important and you focus on that. So in 2 Timothy chapter 4, here's Paul in prison sitting under the iron fist of the Roman Empire, facing execution. And what he writes about is, and the people are going to depart from the faith and they're going to be turned unto fables. Well, and it talks about, even in some of the other passages, silly women being driven by their own emotions are going to be a problem. And I'm just saying that I'm not a prophet or particularly prescient. I just try to pay attention. And I saw this coming back in the 90s. Now, it may be, I will say this, in August, I'm going to read in my prophecy update from a national conference, a big national conference talk that my father gave in Long Beach, California in August of 1970, 50 years ago. And so I don't always remember a lot of what my dad said in his messages, but I went back, I have a transcript of it, and I went back and read it, and he was concerned about the departure from truth in 1970. So maybe I got it, I inherited it, or I was taught it by my father. But I saw the shift in the law practice back in the, starting in the 1990s. And now we're in a place where I don't know if I want a jury trial for people a lot of times, because the other guy might be better at appealing to their emotions or might have more emotional facts than I do. But the problem is that this permeates everything. It permeates sermons at church. It permeates newscast. It's a major, major problem. It's a complete philosophical shift in our society and culture. And it was prophesied and warned about by the Apostle Paul 2,000 years ago.
Would you associate, the departure from truth, man, we could spend days on this. Obviously, there is this desire by people to see justice take place in America, to see, as we talked about earlier, to see people go to jail. But there's this need for people to have hope. And I think people have found it in the Q phenomenon, what we know as the Q phenomenon or the Q or whatever you want to call that. And that's become very popular. So, having said that, and you also touched on the indictment, the whatever, 100 and some or 200,000, whatever the number is, it's just insane to believe that that's even close to being accurate. You're a trial attorney. The numbers aren't there. I mean, simply aren't there. But anyway, having said all of that, is this part of it, I guess? This hopium, is this part of this, part and parcel with departure from truth?
Yeah, I think that, I think this, again, I think that the one thing we need to realize is that Satan plays both sides. I have talked about this, and others have talked about this, that for a number of years, I can remember doing talks and some conferences on it back in 2008 with some friends, that there's this belief, and who, somebody sent me a video just this morning. Oh, it was Mike Heiser, Dr. Heiser, speaking on this exact problem, that there's this utopian belief that kind of permeates a lot of both the left, you know, the left that wants to build this perfect utopian society. But there's also this thinking on the right, and I think I see it manifested in the Q movement somewhat, quite a bit, that we're going to build this perfect society. I think this is and it translates into churches with what we call dominionism and the New Apostolic Reformation, but it's also on the left. A friend of mine many years ago, Martin Erdman, wrote a book called Building the Kingdom of God on Earth. And what he did was he went back and he traced the development of the Rockefeller Foundation and some of the things that were going on there into the John Foster Dulles and his brother pushing these things through the Wilson administration and the State Department and that type of thing to build this utopian society that led to the League of Nations, that led to the UN, that led, I mean, last Sunday I used a quote from the UN website, UNNWO. Now, I don't know if they're affiliated with the UN, but they certainly use the UN logo, and it's UNNWO, UNNewWorldOrder.org. And they have a section on there about promoting happytalism, because they want to build this utopian, happy society where everybody's needs are met and everybody is taken care of. Let me try to make a little connection. This is, my wife would say, if she was sitting in the back of the room right now, this is where she would be doing this circle thing that she does when I can see her in the back of the room when I'm talking. And what that means is that it means, okay, bring it in for a landing. It's time to make your point. And bless her heart. And she's usually right. So there is a tremendous connection between all of these different strains about building this perfect society. And I think it is a pipe dream. It leads to, unfortunately, a lot of deception. In Matthew chapter 24, when Jesus was approached by his disciples about the end times, what are the signs to be? What he warned more about than anything else, I mean, he warned about wars, earthquakes, famines, pestilence, all this. Four times more than that, he warned about that. He warned about, take heed that no man deceive you, that false Christ would come, not singular, but false Christ would come and deceive many. And so I think as Christians, we need to be on guard for that, because it is something that sort of permeates everything. So when you see this, you see what Gates is doing now with his foundation money and the billions of dollars that he's funded them with. You see what the Rockefeller Foundation has done. A lot of it has been under the guise of philanthropy and setting up this perfect society. As I've talked to people about this, I know there are elites that are trying to set up this world government, this globalist and that type of thing. And my view is that when it's God will let it happen when it's time, and we should always be aware of it and always be on guard against it and fight it. But it's going to happen at some point. They've been at it for hundreds of years and they haven't succeeded really. So maybe they're just not very good at it. At least that's my view. But there's certainly everybody's trying. And they've been trying for a long time. And so we need to be on guard for this from both sides of the political spectrum, because the temptation or the potentiality for being deceived in these things is there on both sides. And if you remember, I was actually on your show back in, it was probably the fall of 2017, like 2.5 years ago, when the number of indictments was 3,000 or 8,000.
Yes.
And they're like, they're taking down the deep state. Everybody's going to jail. And now the number's up to like 175,000. And I've explained many times why that the data is totally flawed. if there were that many indictments, all the white collar lawyers in the world, like me, when you know, they tried to drag me into an investigation to get me off a case, or when they tried to, you know, they drug other people in, everybody lawyers up. So if there were that many indictments out there, even though they were sealed, there would be a buzz in the legal community like you've never seen, and there's nothing. If you talk to white collar lawyers and say, did you know there's 175, 200,000 sealed indictments? They would look at you like, what planet did you walk off of? Because it is a secret process, but it's not completely unknown, because like one investigation I was involved in representing people, everybody in town knew it. Everybody in town knew who was getting subpoenaed to the grand jury, and everybody kind of knew where they were going. So if this was happening on a massive scale, multiply what I saw there by 175,000 lawyers, you know, all over Washington and other cities across the country, there would be a buzz, and there's not. So the thing is, we've got to be very careful about letting our hope letting our hope run wild and falling for some of this stuff.
Amen.
Because I think it's hard to do, because, but there are some things going on. Like right now, it's somebody was writing to me today, and they're like, I don't know what to believe anymore.
There it is.
He goes, I see this. Maybe that's part of, and I told him, I said, I think that's part of the plan, to get you to question everything, because eventually you're going to start questioning aspects of your faith. And we saw another pastor's kid who was in a Christian band come out this week and say, I no longer believe in God. You think it just happened overnight? That guy's been under assault since he was a kid by all this nonsense. And so the hard thing for Christians is we can't fall for everything that comes down the pipe. We gotta question it, but we gotta be committed to the truth and looking for the truth. And so that's sort of what drives me in my ministry and what we do at Fellowship Bible Chapel and what I try to do in talks. And I'll confess, I don't know that I have it all figured out. You know, I'm not, times I'm less dogmatic on how this whole Bible prophecy thing plays out than I was 10 or 15 years ago, because what the world was like 10 or 15 years ago is not what the world is like now. And all these Bible prophecies will unfold in a real world that people are living in. So we need to be a little bit flexible, I think, and less dogmatic about our views on these things. So I feel like I'm rambling now.
No, you know what? I think what you just said there in summary is why people really enjoy, get a lot out of your prophecy updates. Folks, if you haven't done so, the link to the YouTube prophecy updates will be in the program description box at HagmanReportLive.com. That's where you find the links. And your balanced approach to things, it combined with your real world experience, especially in the legal arena, makes, to me, your show prep for me, the research you do. I remember one that you did, one prophecy update you did, I don't know, it was right after things started happening with the lockdown. You know what? I'll tell you what, it was a fantastic, eye-opening geopolitical debriefing for me, or briefing for me. When I say geopolitical, I'm talking about you went from California to Japan, you know, I mean, around the world, and really assessed everything through the lens of biblical prophecy. And the way you did it was a work of art. So folks, please, Fellowship Bible Chapel, fbchapel.com. I want to make sure I got that right. And also as well as the prophecy updates that John Haller does. I feel like I'm rambling now, so I don't want to go any
further.
Well,
I would just say, look, I appreciate those comments. And if you remember, 5.5 years ago, 1 mile from my house, we did that what something about the world turned upside down or something, prophecy conference down here at the Dublin Community Center.
Yep.
Which is locked down now. I mean, I can't go down there and work out because of the concerns over this thing. And I don't know when it'll ever open again. And but you know, it's a great facility. And remember, you moderated a panel, and I think there was Doug Krieger, Bill Salas, myself. I think you and Joe were monitoring the panel, and Chris Putnam, late Chris Putnam.
Yes, and I need to apologize. I got to tell you right now, I need to apologize to you. That was the worst moderating job that anyone could have ever done, and I'm going to leave it at that. So go ahead.
Well, no, as you recall, some of the people on the panel kind of got into a heated argument about the timing of the rapture and that type of thing. And you finally said, John, do you have anything to say? And I said, you know, I love everybody. And I really do. Even people who have different views on the timing of the rapture or some other things than I do. I think there are some views that I see espoused on some of these videos are quite dangerous when you think through the implications of what the people are saying. And I think if the person was sitting there, but I think the thing is that we'll soon, I think, know who was right on all these different aspects of Bible prophecy. I kind of put things into baskets of possibility, and I try to be accurate, but I don't profess to say that I've got everything all figured out. Because there are people, they drill down into other stuff that I never drill down into. But I usually spend 30 hours or so to prepare what I, and the graphics and everything, and read and that type of thing each week. Sometimes I'm a little bit far behind other people, what they're talking about, just because I'm not comfortable with, I'm not ready to get out there and say, this is that type thing. But, you know, like today, you mentioned geopolitics. So maybe we can turn to that for just a few moments, the time we have left. The geopoliticals, aside from the coronavirus thing, the geopolitical system is in complete turmoil right now. Now, look, I read a lot of material that I don't agree with. I read Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy. Foreign Affairs is published by the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, they will draw from a wide variety of views and everything, but they're basically globalist, New World Order types. They're Foreign Policy a little less so. I read dozens of newspapers every day, magazines, publications, books, and there are some really... The world is really in a state of turmoil. I don't know how else to say it. So I saw Dr. Heiser's presentation on the utopian society and how it's kind of comes from both sides of the political spectrum. And I only watched about 30 minutes of it. It's about 3 hours long. But in it, he raised an issue. That was one thing I've been talking about for quite a while. And there was a video that he referred to. It's about 9 years old, and I'm trying to think what the title of the video is. If you see Heiser's thing, it's in the early part of it, World Demographic Breakdown or Collapse. And we're living at a time where the demographics of the world that we've known, it's hard to grasp because it seems like population is still increasing. But the population is rapidly aging, and old people don't have children. So what's happening, like last year, Japan lost 500,000 or a million in population because they're dying off. The same thing is going to happen to China. While China might have 1.4 billion people now, by assume the Lord doesn't return, by the end of the century, their population will be down to a billion. The most rapidly aging population on the planet right now is the nation of Iran. And we know that a lot of these people are players in Bible prophecy. And the only thing I bring up the demographics to is suggest that the leaders of those countries know that they're in decline. And they want to protect their legacy. So things that the Bible says they're going to do, I think they're more likely to do because of this demographic collapse. I was first turned on to it by a book by Mark Stein called America Alone. And he talked about the demographic collapse in Europe, Western Europe, and in Russia and other countries around the world. Now, America, he said, seems to be protected somewhat because we allow a little more immigration. But other countries are collapsing demographically. And we see what happens in Europe. As the populations collapse, they bring in immigrant populations that don't share values, which cause a further erosion of society. And it causes people to do things that they wouldn't normally do. For example, a great article I saw this morning in the Gatestone Institute, which is one of the sources that I use because I find their research to be very good. They're talking about free speech being dead in France. Well, I will tell you this. If free speech dies in France, it's dying all over the world, because what's happening in Europe is putting in these very strict speech rules. Well, the internet companies, and you know you've had problem with them, I've had problem with them, with Google and YouTube and Facebook, and I haven't had any trouble with Twitter. I don't use Twitter quite as much. But all these people have problems with free speech, particularly conservative, religious, Christian speech. And they're putting in these speech codes in France. They're going to be adopted by the EU, and the EU is going to apply and say, you're a social media platform, you have to comply with our rules. So what happens is the most restrictive law rules, because Google's not going to say, well, we have to do this in Europe, but we can be more loose with everything in the U.S. They're going to adopt this restrictive rules. So the you know, I don't know how long we're going to be able to be on these platforms. I know there's some other platforms coming out like MeWe and Patreon and those type of things, BitChute, that allow things to stand up. Where I'm part of a group that's setting up a thing. I think I can say it's supposed to be rolled out here in the next week or so, called Remnant Truth Network, where we're going to be hosting things on servers apart from YouTube and that type of thing. I like YouTube. I like Facebook because it gets you a lot of bang for the buck. It's free, you know, it's basically free, but you got to comply with their rules. So there are different groups setting up separate servers where these things will be hosted that are not part of, you know, apart from YouTube, so that we can at least use the internet platform as long as the Lord allows us.
Yeah,
to do
we're
that
all doing that. I think at least most of us who see the or experience the
handwriting.
Trouble. Yeah,
handwriting's on the wall clearly.
Yeah.
So I get throttled. I get throttled all the time, and I, to be honest with you, you know, I've tried to complain when. I think every video of mine's in restricted mode now, so that, you know.
Oh, sure.
I guess because I don't use pornography, but I guess the stuff that they let go, but they restrict people like you and I and other Christian people is just, it's just crazy. It's not a utopian world. It's a dystopian world, I guess is the best way to say it. It's insane.
You're exactly correct. I just want to take a real quick break just to show you this. My wife brought this into me when she heard you mention the Dublin conference. That was in 2014, November 14 and 15, 2014. I don't know if that looks familiar. There's the badge.
Yep.
Okay. And of course,
wow.
You know, so, and there's a note there saying, apologize to John Heller. Anyway, no, I remember, yeah, that was a fiery panel that, I learned one thing. Don't let go of the microphone. All right. So anyway, yeah. So, of course, folks, my guest, John Heller, the Fellowship Bible Chapel, and of course, his prophecy updates are immensely popular at John Heller. 54, right, is your Twitter handle, I believe. Well, there it is right there on Twitter. But you don't use that very much. I don't either. You know, I just kind of, I'm there. Facebook as well. But folks, follow John Haller. Please do that. YouTube, Fellowship Bible Chapel, and of course Facebook, Twitter. You can get to all of those by way of fbchapel.com.
If I could just add to, when we started Fellowship Bible Chapel almost exactly seven years ago, we made a commitment that we would hold conferences, we would emphasize, we would not exclusively focus on Bible prophecy. That's my thing. But we have great pastors and teachers, Steve Mitchell, Mike Clapham, and others that and we're sort of expanding our footprint. We have a building now. We've expanded into some modular buildings that we were able to acquire, and we're bringing online. So we'll be streaming more stuff, trying to do Bible studies and that type of thing. But we made a commitment that everything we do at Fellowship Bible Chapel, whether it's a conference or what, we do for free. People, as you know, it's very expensive to put on a conference. And so we just try to bear the cost. We try to do everything for free. We did charge a fee down here at Dublin because we had to rent the facility. But to the extent we do things at church, we try to do everything for free because it's sort of our way of bringing things to the body of Christ. And that's just sort of our, you know, sort of one of our driving goals at FBC.
And God does provide a way. I really believe that. I mean, faced with, you know, oppressive costs or whatever, I think God does provide a way, especially when you're generous with your time and talents like that. So thank you very much, for everything you do. We've got about, I can't believe how quickly this time has gone. We only have about 14 minutes. I mean, seriously, you could come back every day of the week for the next month and we still wouldn't touch on, half the stuff that's going on. We've got elections obviously coming up this year. Any thoughts, kind of on what's going to happen at the Democratic convention? The Republican convention that may or may not be in North Carolina, and ultimately the election of 2020. People are saying, well, Donald Trump's a lock. I don't know. I mean, I don't think anything's a lock. I'm like you. You know, I don't – you look at things and it's – boy, it's – there's nothing for sure out there. So any thoughts
well,
on that or
know,
anywhere
like,
else?
Yeah, 3 months ago in January, we were sitting here thinking that at this time we'd be watching the beginnings of the baseball season and the NHL and NBA playoffs. Yeah. How's that going?
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is that it's just changed so much. And now, you know, there's a big dispute about are they having college this fall? I mean, listen, I live in Columbus, Ohio, so Ohio State is you know, God, mom, apple pie, and Ohio State football it's a big deal around here. You know, there's, you know, football weekends here. The city changes. There's hotels are filled. And now what's going to happen? Is there even going to be a season? I mean, how do you have a football season if somebody on the one guy on the team gets infected, and he's an offensive lineman who's grabbing people. I don't know what's going to happen, Doug. Everything changed in a couple of months. So, you know, we're sitting here at the end of May looking at an election in November in what, 5 months and a week? I think it's less than 180 days away now. But certainly, I think 170 days away, maybe. I really don't know what's going to happen. It's hard for me to envision somebody like Biden being elected, but I will tell you, it's hard for me to envision that somebody like Biden's even going to continue to be the nominee.
Good point.
That Vegas is closed at the moment, but I don't know that they would give you odds on almost anything. They give you odds on almost anything, but I don't know if they'd give you odds on anything having to do with American politics right now. And look, we've had this disgusting display as there is clearly a financial crisis. There are things that the government's trying to do, but there's all these people coming in. Like now I'm seeing these reports that people are going to get $2,000, $4,000 a month for months, it's affecting the economy. We're getting our house ready to sell. So we've had vendors coming over, contractors and that type of thing to just fix up a few little things. And every one of them is telling me, and I can't find anybody to work. People are unemployed, 40 million unemployed. I need somebody to do the work.
Right.
Why can't they find somebody to work? Because they're making 2-3 times as much unemployed as they would be working. So until that ends, I've seen restaurant owners say, until that ends, I'm not even going to bother reopening my restaurant because I don't have time to train all new employees. So once they stop paying all these extra $600 a week to people, I'm not going to bother. And so that exacerbates the problem. And all these proposals, it sounds very much like this left-wing dream of universal basic income that they want to give to people. Let me just dovetail off to this World Economic Forum talk, because I think this is one of the most significant talks. So this Harari guy, the professor from Tel Aviv University, he's a gay, he's in a relationship with some guy, and he gives to left-wing causes. So he's certainly a man of the left. But he gave a talk, I think it was 2 years ago, January, at the World Economic Forum they were talking about artificial intelligence and how that's developing very rapidly. And this is a big concern of mine. I mean, we see things like HR 6666, the TRACE Act, that they want everybody to download these apps to their phone to track people. Now, frankly, Doug, they're already tracking us. I had to buy something the other day. I can't remember what it was. I went out and I bought it. Oh, we had to buy a new washer and dryer because of one on the fritz. Well, now my Facebook feed is full of ads for washers and dryers. And I'm like, it's artificial intelligence that's doing this. And they know that I was looking for that, but they obviously don't know that I bought it. So if Facebook is listening, it'll just say, hey guys, I bought the washer and dryer. Stop sending me ads for a washer and dryer. And I don't need golf sunglasses anymore either. But I still am looking for a new putter. And, it's artificial intelligence, but it doesn't mean artificial wisdom because there's certainly not much wisdom behind it. But I'm concerned about this tracking thing. And what Harari said at this talk was very, very interesting to me. He said, listen, his expertise is medieval history. Now you would think, what does medieval history have to do with a guy getting invited to speak at a World Economic Forum where all the elites of the world gather? But he said this. He said, listen, Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, medieval history, the serfs, the lowest of the low on the totem pole in those societies did provide a service to the lord of the manor. And thus they were kept around because there were things that they could offer. But what's different now is that with the development of our artificial intelligence and robots and that type of thing, there are a lot of people, and he says this in his talk, who will no longer be of any value to society. And what are we going to do with them? And when you couple demographic collapse with the development and technology and type of thing that people may not be even needed, they have no value to provide to society. What are you going to do with that? And how, this is, to me, this is a frightening thing. You should be frightened because I'm a lawyer. You're a lawyer. What value do you bring to anything anyway? I think you could make the case that lawyers don't. There's some things we do that bring value, but we're certainly in some respects a burden on society. with all the rules and regulations that we seem to love. But think about what Harari says, though, is how does this, how's somebody going to take advantage of this, a coming world leader system that's going to do this? I mean, are they going to care about these people who have no useful value? And so as Christians, our worldview is totally 180 degrees from that. We do value humans and individuals, but we have all these people, and they're talking about it openly. They're going to be a whole class of people that they don't offer anything. What's that look like down the road, Doug? That concerns me. I mean, look, I don't know when the Lord's coming back exactly. I've thought this for a lot of years. My dad talked about it, preached about it. It certainly hasn't happened, but it could. But, you know, what? I have great nieces and nephews and family members and stuff, and I'm concerned about their future. And it's, I think it's scary. It's a scary future, particularly if you do not know the Lord. So let me just sort of suggest this, maybe. I see we're kind of running down on time here. Last Sunday, I just sat at the beginning of my thing. I try to tie in scripture. I don't do a very good job of it a lot of times because I presume that people that are listening would have sort of a working knowledge of some of the major Bible prophecy passages. So I don't cover them every Sunday. But I just read from most of the first two chapters of the book of Joel. Because when you study Hebrew prophecy, you know that the Hebrew prophets prophesied for their own time. They usually, those prophecies would also apply to the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ. So they have multiple fulfillments. And as you get closer to the end, sometimes they come into more stark focus than they did. So there's sort of a surface meaning and a deeper meaning. But when you look at Joel, Joel says, listen, when you see the day of the Lord approaching, I guess I'm paraphrasing, sound the Lord, sound the alarm, sound a trumpet in Zion, and gather the people for prayer and fasting and solemn assembly. So I guess this is where I would leave it. You know, Daniel, the prophet Daniel, when he was in Babylon, he was actually reading the scroll of the prophet Jeremiah. And he gets to the part in Jeremiah chapter 25. And Daniel chapter 9 talks about this and says, oh, wait a minute. Our captivity is to be 70 years. And then he checks his calendar. It's 70 years. Now, what's interesting is what Daniel did not do, what I think our inclination would be, is would be to buy a return ticket to Jerusalem to go back. What he did was he looked at what Jeremiah said. He looked at what had unfolded and what led to the captivity and the sins of the people and that type of thing. And very much like Joel talks about, and Daniel repented and prayed and fasted when he saw this time coming where this prophecy was actually being fulfilled. And so I think it's a good admonition for us as we see just the swirling events around us to step back, calm down a little bit. God is in control, but deal with the issues in our own lives, the sins and distractions and that type of thing that sort of want to take us away from the knowledge of the Lord. So the admonition of Joel and Daniel is when they saw this stuff coming to pass, they got down on behalf of themselves and their nation and repented.
And that is exactly, I think, the words we need to hear. John Heller, I want to say thank you very, very much for your gracious gift of time. Hey, I'll be watching your prophecy updates and telling everyone about it. Thank you again very much. God bless you.
God bless you and thanks.
All right, folks, that'll do it. I'm out of time. I want to thank you for listening. Thank you so much for your support of this platform, your belief and your trust. And again, guests like John Heller. I don't. You just don't get much better than that. I'm telling you. Thank you so very much. Have a great evening, everyone. Good night.